If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 14 of The House of the Seven Gables. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The House of the Seven Gables by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 14. Phoebe's Goodbye. Holgrave, plunging into his tale with the energy and absorption natural to a young author, had given a good deal of action to the parts capable of being developed and exemplified in that manner. He now observed that a certain remarkable drowsiness, wholly unlike that with which the reader possibly feels himself affected, had been flung over the senses of his auditress. It was the effect, unquestionably, of the mystic gesticulations by which he had sought to bring bodily before Phoebe's perception the figure of the mesmerizing carpenter. With the lids drooping over her eyes, now lifted for an instant and drawn down again as with leaden weights, she leaned slightly towards him and seemed almost to regulate her breath by his. Holgrave gazed at her, as he rolled up his manuscript, and recognized an incipient stage of that curious psychological condition which, as he had himself told Phoebe, he possessed more than an ordinary faculty of producing. A veil was beginning to be muffled about her, in which she could behold only him, and live only in his thoughts and emotions. His glance, as he fastened it on the young girl, grew involuntarily more concentrated. In his attitude there was the consciousness of power, investing his hardly mature figure with a dignity that did not belong to its physical manifestation. It was evident that, with but one wave of his hand, and a corresponding effort of his will, he could complete his mastery over Phoebe's yet free and virgin spirit. He could establish an influence over this good, pure, and simple child, as dangerous, and perhaps as disastrous, as that which the carpenter of his legend had acquired and exercised over the ill-fated Alice. To a disposition like Holgrave's, at once speculative and active, there is no temptation so great as the opportunity of acquiring empire over the human spirit, nor any idea more seductive to a young man than to become the arbiter of a young girl's destiny. Let us, therefore, whatever his defects of nature and education, and in spite of his scorn for creeds and institutions, concede to the daguerreotypist the rare and high quality of reverence for another's individuality. Let us allow him integrity, also, for ever after to be confided in, since he forbade himself to twine that one link more which might have rendered his spell over Phoebe indissoluble. He made a slight gesture upward with his hand. "You really mortify me, my dear Miss Phoebe," he exclaimed, smiling half-sarcastically at her. "My poor story, it is but too evident, will never do for Godey or Graham. Only think of your falling asleep at what I hoped the newspaper critics would pronounce a most brilliant, powerful, imaginative, pathetic, and original winding up. Well, the manuscript must serve to light lamps with, if indeed, being so imbued with my gentle dullness, it is any longer capable of flame."
"Me asleep? How can you say so?" answered Phoebe, as unconscious of the crisis through which she had passed, as an infant of the precipice to the verge of which it is rolled. "No, no. I consider myself as having been very attentive, and though I don't remember the incidents quite distinctly, yet I have an impression of a vast deal of trouble and calamity. So, no doubt, the story will prove exceedingly attractive."
By this time the sun had gone down and was tinting the clouds towards the zenith with those bright hues which are not seen there until some time after sunset, and when the horizon has quite lost its richer brilliancy. The moon, too, which had long been climbing overhead, and unobtrusively melting its disk into the azure, like an ambitious demagogue who hides his aspiring purpose by assuming the prevalent hue of popular sentiment, now began to shine out, broad and oval, in its middle pathway. These silvery beams were already powerful enough to change the character of the lingering daylight. They softened and embellished the aspect of the old house, although the shadows fell deeper into the angles of its many gables, and lay brooding under the projecting story, and within the half-open door. With the lapse of every moment, the garden grew more picturesque. The fruit trees, shrubbery, and flower bushes had a dark obscurity among them. The commonplace characteristics, which at noontide it seemed to have taken a century of sordid life to accumulate, were now transfigured by a charm of romance. 100 mysterious years were whispering among the leaves whenever the slight sea breeze found its way thither and stirred them. Through the foliage that roofed the little summer house, the moonlight flickered to and fro, and fell silvery white on the dark floor, the table, and the circular bench, with a continual shift in play, according as the chinks and wayward crevices among the twigs admitted or shut out the glimmer. So sweetly cool was the atmosphere, after all the feverish day, that the summer eve might be fancied as sprinkling dews and liquid moonlight, with a dash of icy temper in them, out of a silver vase. Here and there a few drops of this freshness were scattered on a human heart, and gave it youth again, and sympathy with the eternal youth of nature. The artist chanced to be one on whom the reviving influence fell. It made him feel, what he sometimes almost forgot, thrust so early as he had been into the rude struggle of man with man, how youthful he still was. "It seems to me," he observed, "that I never watched the coming of so beautiful an eve, and never felt anything so very much like happiness as at this moment. After all, what a good world we live in! How good and beautiful! How young it is, too, with nothing really rotten or age-worn in it! This old house, for example, which sometimes has positively oppressed my breath with its smell of decaying timber. And this garden, where the black mold always clings to my spade, as if I were a sexton delving in a graveyard. Could I keep the feeling that now possesses me, the garden would every day be virgin soil, with the earth's first freshness and the flavor of its beans and squashes. And the house, it would be like a bower in Eden, blossoming with the earliest roses that God ever made. Moonlight, and the sentiment in man's heart responsive to it, are the greatest of renovators and reformers. And all other reform and renovation, I suppose, will prove to be no better than moonshine."
"I have been happier than I am now, at least much gayer," said Phoebe thoughtfully. "Yet I am sensible of a great charm in this brightening moonlight, and I love to watch how the day, tired as it is, lags away reluctantly, and hates to be called yesterday so soon. I never cared much about moonlight before. What is there, I wonder, so beautiful in it tonight?"
"And you have never felt it before?" inquired the artist, looking earnestly at the girl through the twilight.
"Never," answered Phoebe. "And life does not look the same, now that I have felt it so. It seems as if I had looked at everything hitherto in broad daylight, or else in the ruddy light of a cheerful fire, glimmering and dancing through a room. Ah, poor me," she added with a half-melancholy laugh, "I shall never be so merry as before I knew Cousin Hepzibah and poor Cousin Clifford. I have grown a great deal older in this little time. Older, and I hope wiser, and not exactly sadder, but certainly with not half so much lightness in my spirits. I have given them my sunshine, and have been glad to give it, but of course I cannot both give and keep it. They are welcome, notwithstanding."
"You have lost nothing, Phoebe, worth keeping, nor which it was possible to keep," said Holgrave after a pause. "Our first youth is of no value, for we are never conscious of it until after it is gone. But sometimes, always, I suspect, unless one is exceedingly unfortunate, there comes a sense of second youth, gushing out of the heart's joy at being in love, or possibly it may come to crown some other grand festival in life, if any other such there be. This bemoaning of oneself, as you do now, over the first, careless, shallow gaiety of youth departed, and this profound happiness at youth regained, so much deeper and richer than that we lost, are essential to the soul's development. In some cases, the two states come almost simultaneously, and mingle the sadness and the rapture in one mysterious emotion."
"I hardly think I understand you," said Phoebe.
"No wonder," replied Holgrave, smiling, "for I have told you a secret which I hardly began to know before I found myself giving it utterance. Remember it, however, and when the truth becomes clear to you, then think of this moonlight scene."
"It is entirely moonlight now, except only a little flush of faint crimson upward from the west, between those buildings," remarked Phoebe. "I must go in. Cousin Hepzibah is not quick at figures, and will give herself a headache over the day's accounts, unless I help her."
But Holgrave detained her a little longer. "Miss Hepzibah tells me," observed he, "that you return to the country in a few days."
"Yes, but only for a little while," answered Phoebe. "For I look upon this as my present home. I go to make a few arrangements, and to take a more deliberate leave of my mother and friends. It is pleasant to live where one is much desired and very useful, and I think I may have the satisfaction of feeling myself so here."
"You surely may, and more than you imagine," said the artist. "Whatever health, comfort, and natural life exists in the house is embodied in your person. These blessings came along with you, and will vanish when you leave the threshold. Miss Hepzibah, by secluding herself from society, has lost all true relation with it, and is, in fact, dead, although she galvanizes herself into a semblance of life, and stands behind her counter, afflicting the world with a greatly to be deprecated scowl. Your poor cousin Clifford is another dead and long-buried person, on whom the governor and council have wrought a necromantic miracle. I should not wonder if he were to crumble away some morning, after you are gone, and nothing be seen of him more, except a heap of dust. Miss Hepzibah, at any rate, will lose what little flexibility she has. They both exist by you."
"I should be very sorry to think so,"
answered Phoebe gravely. "But it is true that my small abilities were precisely what they needed, and I have a real interest in their welfare, an odd kind of motherly sentiment, which I wish you would not laugh at. And let me tell you frankly, Mr. Holgrave, I am sometimes puzzled to know whether you wish them well or ill."
"Undoubtedly," said the daguerreotypist, "I do feel an interest in this antiquated, poverty-stricken old maiden lady, and this degraded and shattered gentleman, this abortive lover of the beautiful. A kindly interest, too, helpless old children that they are. But you have no conception what a different kind of heart mine is from your own. It is not my impulse, as regards these two individuals, either to help or hinder, but to look on, to analyze, to explain matters to myself, and to comprehend the drama which, for almost 200 years, has been dragging its slow length over the ground where you and I now tread. If permitted to witness the close, I doubt not to derive a moral satisfaction from it, go matters how they may. There is a conviction within me that the end draws nigh. But though Providence sent you hither to help, and sends me only as a privileged and meet spectator, I pledge myself to lend these unfortunate beings whatever aid I can."
"I wish you would speak more plainly," cried Phoebe, perplexed and displeased. "And above all, that you would feel more like a Christian and a human being. How is it possible to see people in distress without desiring, more than anything else, to help and comfort them? You talk as if this old house were a theatre, and you seem to look at Hepzibah's and Clifford's misfortunes, and those of generations before them, as a tragedy, such as I have seen acted in the hall of a country hotel. Only the present one appears to be played exclusively for your amusement. I do not like this. The play costs the performers too much, and the audience is too cold-hearted."
"You are severe," said Holgrave, compelled to recognize a degree of truth in the piquant sketch of his own mood.
"And then," continued Phoebe, "what can you mean by your conviction, which you tell me of, that the end is drawing near? Do you know of any new trouble hanging over my poor relatives? If so, tell me at once, and I will not leave them."
"Forgive me, Phoebe," said the daguerreotypist, holding out his hand, to which the girl was constrained to yield her own. "I am somewhat of a mystic, it must be confessed. The tendency is in my blood, together with the faculty of mesmerism, which might have brought me to Gallows Hill in the good old times of witchcraft. Believe me, if I were really aware of any secret, the disclosure of which would benefit your friends, who are my own friends likewise, you should learn it before we part. But I have no such knowledge."
"You hold something back," said Phoebe.
"Nothing, no secrets but my own," answered Holgrave. "I can perceive, indeed, that Judge Pyncheon still keeps his eye on Clifford, in whose ruin he had so large a share. His motives and intentions, however, are a mystery to me. He is a determined and relentless man, with the genuine character of an inquisitor, and had he any object to gain by putting Clifford to the rack, I verily believe that he would wrench his joints from their sockets in order to accomplish it. But, so wealthy and eminent as he is, so powerful in his own strength and in the support of society on all sides, what can Judge Pyncheon have to hope or fear from the imbecile, branded, half-torpid Clifford?"
"Yet," urged Phoebe, "you did speak as if misfortune were impending."
"Oh, that was because I am morbid," replied the artist. "My mind has a twist aside, like almost everybody's mind, except your own. Moreover, it is so strange to find myself an inmate of this old Pyncheon house, and sitting in this old garden, hark how Maul's well is murmuring, that, were it only for this one circumstance,
I cannot help fancying that destiny is arranging its fifth act for a catastrophe."
"There!"
cried Phoebe with renewed vexation, for she was by nature as hostile to mystery as the sunshine to a dark corner.
"You puzzle me more than ever."
"Then let us part friends," said Holgrave, pressing her hand. "Or if not friends, let us part before you entirely hate me. You, who love everybody else in the world."
"Goodbye, then," said Phoebe frankly. "I do not mean to be angry a great while, and should be sorry to have you think so. There has Cousin Hepzibah been standing in the shadow of the doorway this quarter of an hour past. She thinks I stay too long in the damp garden. So good night and goodbye."
On the second morning thereafter, Phoebe might have been seen, in her straw bonnet, with a shawl on one arm and a little carpet-bag on the other, bidding adieu to Hepzibah and Cousin Clifford. She was to take a seat in the next train of cars, which would transport her to within half a dozen miles of her country village. The tears were in Phoebe's eyes. A smile, dewy with affectionate regret, was glimmering around her pleasant mouth. She wondered how it came to pass that her life of a few weeks, here in this heavy-hearted old mansion, had taken such hold of her, and so melted into her associations, as now to seem a more important center-point of remembrance than all which had gone before. How had Hepzibah, grim, silent, and irresponsive to her overflow of cordial sentiment, contrived to win so much love? And Clifford, in his abortive decay, with the mystery of fearful crime upon him, and the close prison atmosphere yet lurking in his breath, how had he transformed himself into the simplest child whom Phoebe felt bound to watch over and be, as it were, the providence of his unconsidered hours? Everything at that instant of farewell stood out prominently to her view. Look where she would, lay her hand on what she might, the object responded to her consciousness as if a moist human heart were in it. She peeped from the window into the garden, and felt herself more regretful at leaving this spot of black earth, vitiated with such an age-long growth of weeds, than joyful at the idea of again scenting her pine forests and fresh clover fields. She called Chanticleer, his two wives, and the venerable Chicken, and threw them some crumbs of bread from the breakfast-table. These being hastily gobbled up, the Chicken spread its wings and alighted close by Phoebe on the window-sill, where it looked gravely into her face and vented its emotions in a croak. Phoebe bade it be a good old chicken during her absence, and promised to bring it a little bag of buckwheat.
"Ah, Phoebe," remarked Hepzibah, "you do not smile so naturally as when you came to us. Then the smile chose to shine out. Now you choose it should. It is well that you are going back, for a little while, into your native air. There has been too much weight on your spirits. The house is too gloomy and lonesome. The shop is full of vexations. And as for me, I have no faculty of making things look brighter than they are. Dear Clifford has been your only comfort."
"Come hither, Phoebe,"
suddenly cried her cousin Clifford, who had said very little all the morning.
"Close, closer, and look me in the face."
Phoebe put one of her small hands on each elbow of his chair, and leaned her face towards him, so that he might peruse it as carefully as he would. It is probable that the latent emotions of this parting hour had revived, in some degree, his bedimmed and enfeebled faculties. At any rate, Phoebe soon felt that, if not the profound insight of a seer, yet a more than feminine delicacy of appreciation was making her heart the subject of its regard. A moment before, she had known nothing which she would have sought to hide. Now, as if some secret were hinted to her own consciousness through the medium of another's perception, she was fain to let her eyelids droop beneath Clifford's gaze. A blush, too, the redder, because she strove hard to keep it down, ascended bigger and higher, in a tide of fitful progress, until even her brow was all suffused with it.
"It is enough, Phoebe," said Clifford, with a melancholy smile. "When I first saw you, you were the prettiest little maiden in the world, and now you have deepened into beauty. Girlhood has passed into womanhood. The bud is a bloom. Go now. I feel lonelier than I did."
Phoebe took leave of the desolate couple, and passed through the shop, twinkling her eyelids to shake off a dewdrop. For, considering how brief her absence was to be, and therefore the folly of being cast down about it, she would not so far acknowledge her tears as to dry them with her handkerchief. On the doorstep, she met the little urchin whose marvelous feats of gastronomy have been recorded in the earlier pages of our narrative. She took from the window some specimen or other of natural history, her eyes being too dim with moisture to inform her accurately whether it was a rabbit or a hippopotamus, put it into the child's hand as a parting gift, and went her way. Old Uncle Venner was just coming out of his door, with a wood-horse and saw on his shoulder, and, trudging along the street, he scrupled not to keep company with Phoebe, so far as their paths lay together, nor, in spite of his patched coat and rusty beaver, and the curious fashion of his tow-cloth trousers, could she find it in her heart to outwalk him.
"We shall miss you next Sabbath afternoon," observed the street philosopher. "It is unaccountable how little while it takes some folks to grow just as natural to a man as his own breath. And, begging your pardon, Miss Phoebe, though there can be no offence in an old man saying it, that's just what you've grown to me. My years have been a great many, and your life is but just beginning. And yet you are somehow as familiar to me as if I'd found you at my mother's door, and you had blossomed like a running vine all along my pathway since. Come back soon, or I shall be gone to my farm, for I begin to find these wood-sawing jobs a little too tough for my backache."
"Very soon, Uncle Venner," replied Phoebe.
"And let it be all the sooner, Phoebe, for the sake of those poor souls yonder," continued her companion. "They can never do without you now. Never, Phoebe, never. No more than if one of God's angels had been living with them and making their dismal house pleasant and comfortable. Doesn't it seem to you they'd be in a sad case if, some pleasant summer morning like this, the angel should spread his wings and fly to the place he came from? Well, just so they feel, now that you're going home by the railroad. They can't bear it, Miss Phoebe, so be sure to come back."
"I see no angel, Uncle Venner," said Phoebe, smiling, as she offered him her hand at the street corner. "But I suppose people never feel so much like angels as when they are doing what little good they may, so I shall certainly come back." Thus parted the old man and the rosy girl, and Phoebe took the wings of the morning, and was soon flitting almost as rapidly away as if endowed with the aerial locomotion of the angels to whom Uncle Venner had so graciously compared her. End of chapter.
Chapter 15 of The House of the Seven Gables. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The House of the Seven Gables by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 15, The Scowl and Smile. Several days passed over the Seven Gables, heavily and drearily enough. In fact, not to attribute the whole gloom of sky and earth to the one inauspicious circumstance of Phoebe's departure, an easterly storm had set in, and indefatigably apply itself to the task of making the black roof and walls of the old house look more cheerless than ever before. Yet was the outside not half so cheerless as the interior. Poor Clifford was cut off at once from all his scanty resources of enjoyment. Phoebe was not there, nor did the sunshine fall upon the floor. The garden, with its muddy walks, and the chill, dripping foliage of its summer-house, was an image to be shuddered at. Nothing flourished in the cold, moist, pitiless atmosphere, drifting with the brackish scud of sea-breezes, except the moss along the joints of the shingle roof, and the great bunch of weeds that had lately been suffering from drought in the angle between the two front gables. As for Hepzibah, she seemed not merely possessed with the east wind, but to be, in her very person, only another phase of this gray and sullen spell of weather, the east wind itself, grim and disconsolate, in a rusty black silk gown, and with a turban of cloud wreaths on its head. The custom of the shop fell off, because a story got abroad that she soured her small beer and other damageable commodities by scowling on them. It is perhaps true that the public had something reasonably to complain of in her deportment, but towards Clifford she was neither ill-tempered nor unkind, nor felt less warmth of heart than always, had it been possible to make it reach him. The inutility of her best efforts, however, palsied the poor old gentlewoman. She could do little else than sit silently in a corner of the room when the wet pear-tree branches, sweeping across the small windows, created a noonday dusk, which Hepzibah unconsciously darkened with her woe-begone aspect. It was no fault of Hepzibah's. Everything, even the old chairs and tables, that had known what weather was for three or four such lifetimes as her own, looked as damp and chill as if the present were their worst experience. The picture of the Puritan colonel shivered on the wall. The house itself shivered, from every attic of its seven gables down to the great kitchen fireplace, which served all the better as an emblem of the mansion's heart, because, though built for warmth, it was now so comfortless and empty. Hepzibah attempted to enliven matters by a fire in the parlor, but the storm demon kept watch above, and whenever a flame was kindled, drove the smoke back again, choking the chimney's sooty throat with its own breath. Nevertheless, during 4 days of this miserable storm, Clifford wrapped himself in an old cloak and occupied his customary chair. On the morning of the 5th, when summoned to breakfast, he responded only by a broken-hearted murmur, expressive of a determination not to leave his bed. His sister made no attempt to change his purpose. In fact, entirely as she loved him, Hepzibah could hardly have borne any longer the wretched duty, so impracticable by her few and rigid faculties, of seeking pastime for a still sensitive but ruined mind, critical and fastidious, without force or volition. It was at least something short of positive despair that today she might sit shivering alone and not suffer continually a new grief, an unreasonable pang of remorse, at every fitful sigh of her fellow-sufferer. But Clifford, it seemed, though he did not make his appearance below stairs, had, after all, bestirred himself in quest of amusement. In the course of the forenoon, Hepzibah heard a note of music, which, there being no other tuneful contrivance in the House of the Seven Gables, she knew must proceed from Alice Pyncheon's harpsichord. She was aware that Clifford, in his youth, had possessed a cultivated taste for music, and a considerable degree of skill in its practice. It was difficult, however, to conceive of his retaining an accomplishment to which daily exercise is so essential, in the measure indicated by the sweet, airy, and delicate, though most melancholy strain, that now stole upon her ear. Nor was it less marvelous that the long silent instrument should be capable of so much melody. Hepzibah involuntarily thought of the ghostly harmonies, prelusive of death in the family, which were attributed to the legendary Alice. but it was, perhaps, proof of the agency of other than spiritual fingers, that, after a few touches, the chords seemed to snap asunder with their own vibrations, and the music ceased. But a harsher sound succeeded to the mysterious notes, nor was the easterly day fated to pass without an event sufficient in itself to poison, for Hepzibah and Clifford, the balmiest air that ever brought the hummingbirds along with it. The final echoes of Alice Pyncheon's performance, or Clifford's, if his we must consider it, were driven away by no less vulgar a dissonance than the ringing of the shop bell. A foot was heard scraping itself on the threshold, and thence somewhat ponderously stepping on the floor. Hepzibah delayed a moment, while muffling herself in a faded shawl, which had been her defensive armor in a 40 years' warfare against the east wind. A characteristic sound, however, neither a cough nor a hem, but a kind of rumbling and reverberating spasm in somebody's capacious depth of chest, impelled her to hurry forward with that aspect of fierce faint-heartedness so common to women in cases of perilous emergency. Few of her sex, on such occasions, have ever looked so terrible as our poor scowling Hepzibah. But the visitor quietly closed the shop door behind him, stood up his umbrella against the counter, and turned a visage of composed benignity to meet the alarm and anger which his appearance had excited. Hepzibah's presentiment had not deceived her. It was no other than Judge Pyncheon, who, after in vain trying the front door, had now effected his entrance into the shop.
"How do you do, Cousin Hepzibah? And how does this most inclement weather affect our poor Clifford?" began the judge, and wonderful it seemed, indeed, that the easterly storm was not put to shame, or, at any rate, a little modified by the genial benevolence of his smile. "I could not rest without calling to ask once more whether I can in any manner promote his comfort or your own."
"You can do nothing," said Hepzibah, controlling her agitation as well as she could. "I devote myself to Clifford. He has every comfort which his situation admits of."
"But allow me to suggest, dear cousin," rejoined the judge, "you err, in all affection and kindness, no doubt, and with the very best intentions, but you do err, nevertheless, in keeping your brother so secluded. Why insulate him thus from all sympathy and kindness? Clifford, alas, has had too much of solitude. Now let him try society, the society, that is to say, of kindred and old friends. Let me, for instance, but see Clifford, and I will answer for the good effect of the interview."
"You cannot see him," answered Hepzibah. "Clifford has kept his bed since yesterday."
"What? How? Is he ill?" exclaimed Judge Pyncheon, starting with what seemed to be angry alarm, for the very frown of the old Puritan darkened through the room as he spoke. "Nay, then, I must and will see him. What if he should die?"
"He is in no danger of death,"
said Hepzibah, and added, with bitterness that she could repress no longer,
"None, unless he shall be persecuted to death, now by the same man who long ago attempted it."
"Cousin Hepzibah," said the judge with an impressive earnestness of manner, which grew even to tearful pathos as he proceeded, "is it possible that you do not perceive how unjust, how unkind, how unchristian is this constant, this long-continued bitterness against me, for a part which I was constrained by duty and conscience, by the force of law, and at my own peril, to act? What did I do, in detriment to Clifford, which it was possible to leave undone? How could you, his sister, if for your never-ending sorrow, as it has been for mine, you had known what I did, have shown greater tenderness? And do you think, cousin, that it has cost me no pang, that it has left no anguish in my bosom from that day to this, amidst all the prosperity with which heaven has blessed me, or that I do not now rejoice when it is deemed consistent with the dues of public justice and the welfare of society that this dear kinsman, this early friend, this nature so delicately and beautifully constituted, so unfortunate, let us pronounce him, and forbear to say, so guilty, that our own Clifford, in fine, should be given back to life and its possibilities of enjoyment. Ah, you little know me, Cousin Hepzibah. You little know this heart. It now throbs at the thought of meeting him. There lives not the human being, except yourself, and you not more than I, who has shed so many tears for Clifford's calamity. You behold some of them now. There is none who would so delight to promote his happiness. Try me, Hepzibah. Try me, cousin. Try the man whom you have treated as your enemy and Clifford's. Try Jaffrey Pyncheon, and you shall find him true to the heart's core.
In the name of heaven!
Cried Hepzibah, provoked only to intenser indignation by this outgush of the inestimable tenderness of a stern nature.
In God's name, whom you insult, and whose power I could almost question, since he hears you utter so many false words without palsying your tongue, give over, I beseech you, this loathsome pretense of affection for your victim. You hate him. Say so like a man. You cherish, at this moment, some black purpose against him in your heart. Speak it out at once. Or, if you hope so to promote it better, hide it till you can triumph in its success. But never speak again of your love for my poor brother. I cannot bear it. It will drive me beyond a woman's decency. It will drive me mad. Forbear! Not another word! It will make me spurn you!
For once, Hepzibah's wrath had given her courage. She had spoken. But, after all, was this unconquerable distrust of Judge Pyncheon's integrity, and this utter denial, apparently, of his claim to stand in the ring of human sympathies, were they founded in any just perception of his character, or merely the offspring of a woman's unreasonable prejudice, deduced from nothing? The judge, beyond all question, was a man of eminent respectability. The church acknowledged it, the state acknowledged it. It was denied by nobody. In all the very extensive sphere of those who knew him, whether in his public or private capacities, there was not an individual, except Hepzibah, and some lawless mystic like the daguerreotypist, and possibly a few political opponents, who would have dreamed of seriously disputing his claim to a high and honorable place in the world's regard. Nor, we must do him the further justice to say, did Judge Pyncheon himself, probably, entertain many or very frequent doubts that his enviable reputation accorded with his deserts. His conscience, therefore, usually considered the surest witness to a man's integrity, his conscience, unless it might be for the little space of 5 minutes in the 24 hours, or now and then, some black day in the whole year's cycle, his conscience bore an accordant testimony with the world's laudatory voice. And yet, strong as this evidence may seem to be, we should hesitate to peril our own conscience on the assertion that the judge and the consenting world were right, and that poor Hepzibah, with her solitary prejudice, was wrong. Hidden from mankind, forgotten by himself, or buried so deeply under a sculptured and ornamented pile of ostentatious deeds that his daily life could take no note of it, there may have lurked some evil and unsightly thing. Nay, we could almost venture to say, further, that a daily guilt might have been acted by him, continually renewed, and reddening forth afresh, like the miraculous blood-stain of a murder, without his necessarily and at every moment being aware of it.
men of strong minds, great force of character, and a hard texture of the sensibilities, are very capable of falling into mistakes of this kind. They are ordinary men to whom forms are of paramount importance. Their field of action lies among the external phenomena of life. They possess vast ability in grasping and arranging and appropriating to themselves the big, heavy, solid unrealities, such as gold, landed estate, offices of trust and emolument, and public honors. With these materials, and with deeds of goodly aspect, done in the public eye, an individual of this class builds up, as it were, a tall and stately edifice, which, in the view of other people, and ultimately in his own view, is no other than the man's character, or the man himself. Behold, therefore, a palace. Its splendid halls and suites of spacious apartments are floored with a mosaic work of costly marbles. Its windows, the whole height of each room, admit the sunshine through the most transparent of plate glass. Its high cornices are gilded, and its ceilings gorgeously painted, and a lofty dome, through which, from the central pavement, you may gaze up to the sky, as with no obstructing medium between, surmounts the whole. With what fairer and nobler emblem could any man desire to shadow forth his character? Ah! But in some low and obscure nook, some narrow closet on the ground floor, shut, locked, and bolted, and the key flung away, or beneath the marble pavement, in a stagnant water puddle, with the richest pattern of mosaic work above, may lie a corpse, half-decayed and still decaying, and diffusing its death-scent all through the palace. The inhabitant will not be conscious of it, for it has long been his daily breath. Neither will the visitors, for they smell only the rich odors which the master sedulously scatters through the palace, and the incense which they bring and delight to burn before him. Now and then, perchance, comes in a seer, before whose sadly gifted eye the whole structure melts into thin air, leaving only the hidden nook, the bolted closet, with the cobwebs festooned over its forgotten door, or the deadly hole under the pavement, and the decaying corpse within. Here, then, we are to seek the true emblem of man's character, and of the deed that gives whatever reality it possesses to his life. And, beneath the show of a marble palace, that pool of stagnant water, foul with many impurities, and, perhaps, tinged with blood, that secret abomination above which possibly he may say his prayers without remembering it, is this man's miserable soul. To apply this train of remark somewhat more closely to Judge Pyncheon, we might say, without in the least imputing crime to a personage of his eminent respectability, that there was enough of splendid rubbish in his life to cover up and paralyze a more active and subtle conscience than the judge was ever troubled with. The purity of his judicial character, while on the bench, the faithfulness of his public service in subsequent capacities, his devotedness to his party, and the rigid consistency with which he had adhered to its principles, or, at all events, kept pace with its organized movements, his remarkable zeal as president of a Bible society, his unimpeachable integrity as treasurer of a widow's and orphan's fund, his benefits to horticulture, by producing too much esteemed varieties of the pear, and to agriculture, through the agency of the famous Pyncheon Bull, the cleanliness of his moral deportment, for a great many years past, the severity with which he had frowned upon, and finally cast off, an expensive and dissipated son, delaying forgiveness until within the final quarter of an hour of the young man's life, his prayers at morning and eventide, and graces at mealtime, his efforts in furtherance of the temperance cause, his confining himself, since the last attack of the gout, to 5 diurnal glasses of old sherry wine, the snowy whiteness of his linen, the polish of his boots, the handsomeness of his gold-headed cane,
the square and roomy fashion of his coat, and the fineness of its material, and, in general, the studied propriety of his dress and equipment. The scrupulousness with which he paid public notice, in the street, by a bow, a lifting of the hat, a nod, or a motion of the hand, to all and sundry of his acquaintances, rich or poor. The smile of broad benevolence, wherewith he made it a point to gladden the whole world. What room could possibly be found for darker traits in a portrait made up of lineaments like these? This proper face was what he beheld in the looking-glass. This admirably arranged life was what he was conscious of in the progress of every day. Then might not he claim to be its result and sum, and say to himself and the community, "Behold Judge Pyncheon there!" And allowing that, many, many years ago, in his early and reckless youth, he had committed some one wrong act, or that even now the inevitable force of circumstances should occasionally make him do one questionable deed among a thousand praiseworthy, or at least blameless ones, would you characterize the judge by that one necessary deed and that half-forgotten act, and let it overshadow the fair aspect of a lifetime? What is there so ponderous and evil that a thumb's bigness of it should outweigh the mass of things not evil which were heaped into the other scale? The scale and balance system is a favorite one with people of Judge Pyncheon's brotherhood. A hard, cold man, thus unfortunately situated, seldom or never looking inward, and resolutely taking his idea of himself from what he purports to be his image as reflected in the mirror of public opinion, can scarcely arrive at true self-knowledge, except through loss of property and reputation. Sickness will not always help him do it, not always the death hour. But our affair now is with Judge Pyncheon as he stood confronting the fierce outbreak of Hepzibah's wrath. Without premeditation, to her own surprise, and indeed terror, she had given vent, for once, to the inveteracy of her resentment, cherished against this kinsman for 30 years. Thus far the judge's countenance had expressed mild forbearance, grave and almost gentle deprecation of his cousin's unbecoming violence, free and Christian-like forgiveness of the wrong inflicted by her words. But when those words were irrevocably spoken, his look assumed sternness, the sense of power, an immitigable resolve, and this with so natural and imperceptible a change that it seemed as if the iron man had stood there from the first, and the meek man not at all. The effect was as when the light vapory clouds, with their soft coloring, suddenly vanish from the stony brow of a precipitous mountain, and leave there the frown which you at once feel to be eternal. Hepzibah almost adopted the insane belief that it was her old Puritan ancestor, and not the modern judge, on whom she had just been wreaking the bitterness of her heart. Never did a man show stronger proof of the lineage attributed to him than Judge Pyncheon at this crisis, by his unmistakable resemblance to the picture in the inner room.
"Cousin Hepzibah," said he, very calmly, "it is time to have done with this."
"With all my heart," answered she. "Then why do you persecute us any longer? Leave poor Clifford and me in peace. Neither of us desires anything better."
"It is my purpose to see Clifford before I leave this house," continued the judge. "Do not act like a madwoman, Hepzibah. I am his only friend, and an all-powerful one. Has it never occurred to you, are you so blind as not to have seen, that without not merely my consent, but my efforts, my representations, the exertion of my whole influence, political, official, personal, Clifford would never have been what you call free? Did you think his release a triumph over me? Not so, my good cousin, not so by any means, the furthest possible from that. No, It was the accomplishment of a purpose long entertained on my part. I set him free."
"You!" answered Hepzibah. "I never will believe it. He owed his dungeon to you, his freedom to God's providence."
"I set him free," reaffirmed Judge Pyncheon, with the calmest composure. "And I came hither now to decide whether he shall retain his freedom. It will depend upon himself. For this purpose I must see him."
"Never! It would drive him mad!"
exclaimed Hepzibah, but with an irresoluteness sufficiently perceptible to the keen eye of the judge, for, without the slightest faith in his good intentions, she knew not whether there was most to dread in yielding or resistance.
"And why should you wish to see this wretched, broken man, who retains hardly a fraction of his intellect, and will hide even that from an eye which has no love in it?"
"He shall see love enough in mine, if that be all," said the judge with well-grounded confidence in the benignity of his aspect. "But, Cousin Hepzibah, you confess a great deal, and very much to the purpose. Now, listen, and I will frankly explain my reasons for insisting on this interview. At the death, 30 years since, of our Uncle Jaffrey, it was found, I know not whether the circumstance ever attracted much of your attention among the sadder interests that clustered round that event, but it was found that his visible estate, of every kind, fell far short of any estimate ever made of it. He was supposed to be immensely rich. Nobody doubted that he stood among the weightiest men of his day. It was one of his eccentricities, however, and not altogether a folly, neither, to conceal the amount of his property by making distant and foreign investments, perhaps under other names than his own, and by various means familiar enough to capitalists, but unnecessary here to be specified. By Uncle Jaffrey's last will and testament, as you are aware, his entire property was bequeathed to me, with the single exception of a life interest to yourself in this old family mansion, and the strip of patrimonial estate remaining attached to it."
"And do you seek to deprive us of that?"
asked Hepzibah, unable to restrain her bitter contempt.
"Is this your price for ceasing to persecute poor Clifford?"
"Certainly not, my dear cousin," answered the judge, smiling benevolently. "On the contrary, as you must do me the justice to own, I have constantly expressed my readiness to double or treble your resources, whenever you should make up your mind to accept any kindness of that nature at the hands of your kinsman. No, no, but here lies the gist of the matter. Of my uncle's unquestionably great estate, as I have said, not the half, no, not one-third, as I am fully convinced, was apparent after his death. Now, I have the best possible reasons for believing that your brother Clifford can give me a clue to the recovery of the remainder."
"Clifford? Clifford know of any hidden wealth? Clifford have it in his power to make you rich?"
cried the old gentlewoman, affected with a sense of something like ridicule at the idea.
"Impossible! You deceive yourself. It is really a thing to laugh at."
"It is as certain as that I stand here," said Judge Pyncheon, striking his gold-headed cane on the floor, and at the same time stamping his foot, as if to express his conviction the more forcibly by the whole emphasis of his substantial person. "Clifford told me so himself."
"No, no,"
exclaimed Hepzibah incredulously.
"You are dreaming, Cousin Jaffrey."
"I do not belong to the dreaming class of men," said the judge quietly. "Some months before my uncle's death, Clifford boasted to me of the possession of the secret of incalculable wealth. His purpose was to taunt me and excite my curiosity. I know it well. But from a pretty distinct recollection of the particulars of our conversation,
I am thoroughly convinced that there was truth in what he said. Clifford, at this moment, if he chooses, and choose he must, can inform me where to find the schedule, the documents, the evidences, in whatever shape they exist, of the vast amount of Uncle Jaffrey's missing property. He has the secret. His boast was no idle word. It had a directness, an emphasis, a particularity, that showed a backbone of solid meaning within the mystery of his expression.
"But what could have been Clifford's object?" asked Hepzibah, "in concealing it so long?"
"It was one of the bad impulses of our fallen nature," replied the judge, turning up his eyes. "He looked upon me as his enemy. He considered me as the cause of his overwhelming disgrace, his imminent peril of death, his irretrievable ruin. There was no great probability, therefore, of his volunteering information, out of his dungeon, that should elevate me still higher on the ladder of prosperity. But the moment has now come when he must give up his secret."
"And what if he should refuse?" inquired Hepzibah. "Or, as I steadfastly believe, what if he has no knowledge of this wealth?"
"My dear cousin," said Judge Pyncheon, with a quietude which he had the power of making more formidable than any violence, "since your brother's return I have taken the precaution, a highly proper one in the near kinsman and natural guardian of an individual so situated, to have his deportment and habits constantly and carefully overlooked. Your neighbors have been eyewitnesses to whatever has passed in the garden. The butcher, the baker, the fishmonger, some of the customers of your shop, and many a prying old woman, have told me several of the secrets of your interior. A still larger circle, I myself among the rest, can testify to his extravagances at the arched window. Thousands beheld him a week or two ago, on the point of flinging himself thence into the street. From all this testimony, I am led to apprehend, reluctantly and with deep grief, that Clifford's misfortunes have so affected his intellect, never very strong, that he cannot safely remain at large. The alternative, you must be aware, and its adoption will depend entirely on the decision which I am now about to make. The alternative is his confinement, probably for the remainder of his life, in a public asylum for persons in his unfortunate state of mind."
"You cannot mean it!"
shrieked Hepzibah.
"Should my cousin Clifford," continued Judge Pyncheon, wholly undisturbed, "from mere malice, and hatred of one whose interests ought naturally to be dear to him, a mode of passion that, as often as any other, indicates mental disease, should he refuse me the information so important to myself, and which he assuredly possesses, I shall consider it the one needed jot of evidence to satisfy my mind of his insanity. And once sure of the course pointed out by conscience, you know me too well, Cousin Hepzibah, to entertain a doubt that I shall pursue it."
"Oh, Jaffrey! Cousin Jaffrey!"
cried Hepzibah mournfully, not passionately.
"It is you that are diseased in mind, not Clifford. You have forgotten that a woman was your mother, that you have had sisters, brothers, children of your own, or that there ever was affection between man and man, or pity from one man to another in this miserable world. Else, how could you have dreamed of this? You are not young, Cousin Jaffrey, no, nor middle-aged, but already an old man. The hair is white upon your head. How many years have you to live? Are you not rich enough for that little time? Shall you be hungry? Shall you lack clothes or a roof to shelter you between this point and the grave? No! But with the half of what you now possess, you could revel in costly food and wines, and build a house twice as splendid as you now inhabit.
and make a far greater show to the world, and yet leave riches to your only son to make him bless the hour of your death. Then why should you do this cruel, cruel thing? So mad a thing that I know not whether to call it wicked. Alas, cousin Geoffrey, this hard and grasping spirit has run in our blood these 200 years. You are but doing over again, in another shape, what your ancestor before you did, and sending down to your posterity the curse inherited from him.
"Talk sense, Hepzibah, for heaven's sake!" exclaimed the judge, with the impatience natural to a reasonable man on hearing anything so utterly absurd as the above, in a discussion about matters of business. "I have told you my determination. I am not apt to change. Clifford must give up his secret, or take the consequences. And let him decide quickly, for I have several affairs to attend to this morning, and an important dinner engagement with some political friends."
"Clifford has no secret," answered Hepzibah, "and God will not let you do the thing you meditate."
"We shall see," said the unmoved judge. "Meanwhile, choose whether you will summon Clifford, and allow this business to be amicably settled by an interview between two kinsmen, or drive me to harsher measures, which I should be most happy to feel myself justified in avoiding. The responsibility is altogether on your part."
"You are stronger than I,"
said Hepzibah, after a brief consideration,
"and you have no pity in your strength. Clifford is not now insane, but the interview which you insist upon may go far to make him so. Nevertheless, knowing you as I do, I believe it to be my best course to allow you to judge for yourself as to the improbability of his possessing any valuable secret. I will call Clifford. Be merciful in your dealings with him. Be far more merciful than your heart bids you be, for God is looking at you, Geoffrey Pyncheon."
The judge followed his cousin from the shop, where the foregoing conversation had passed, into the parlour, and flung himself heavily into the great ancestral chair. Many a former Pyncheon had found repose in its capacious arms, rosy children after their sports, young men dreamy with love, grown men weary with cares, old men burdened with winters. They had mused and slumbered and departed to a yet profounder sleep. It had been a long tradition, though a doubtful one, that this was the very chair seated in which the earliest of the judge's New England forefathers, he whose picture still hung upon the wall, had given a dead man's silent and stern reception to the throng of distinguished guests. From that hour of evil omen until the present, it may be, though we know not the secret of his heart, but it may be that no wearier and sadder man had ever sunk into the chair than this same Judge Pyncheon, whom we have just beheld so immitigably hard and resolute. Surely it must have been at no slight cost that he had thus fortified his soul with iron. Such calmness is a mightier effort than the violence of weaker men, and there was yet a heavy task for him to do. Was it a little matter, a trifle to be prepared for in a single moment, and to be wrested from in another moment, that he must now, after 30 years, encounter a kinsman risen from a living tomb, and wrench a secret from him, or else consign him to a living tomb again?
"Did you speak?"
asked Hepzibah, looking in from the threshold of the parlour, for she imagined that the judge had uttered some sound which she was anxious to interpret as a relenting impulse.
"I thought you called me back."
"No, no," gruffly answered Judge Pyncheon with a harsh frown, while his brow grew almost a black purple in the shadow of the room. "Why should I call you back? Time flies. Bid Clifford come to me." The judge had taken his watch from his vest pocket and now held it in his hand, measuring the interval which was to ensue before the appearance of Clifford.
End of chapter. Chapter 16 of The House of the Seven Gables. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain and is read by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The House of the Seven Gables by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 16. Clifford's Chamber. Never had the old house appeared so dismal to poor Hepzibah as when she departed on that wretched errand. There was a strange aspect in it. As she trod along the foot-worn passages, and opened one crazy door after another, and ascended the creaking staircase, she gazed wistfully and fearfully around. It would have been no marvel to her excited mind if, behind or beside her, there had been the rustle of dead people's garments, or pale visages awaiting her on the landing-place above. Her nerves were set all ajar by the scene of passion and terror through which she had just struggled. Her colloquy with Judge Pyncheon, who so perfectly represented the person and attributes of the founder of the family, had called back the dreary past. It weighed upon her heart. Whatever she had heard from legendary aunts and grandmothers concerning the good or evil fortunes of the Pyncheons, stories which had heretofore been kept warm in her remembrance by the chimney-corner glow that was associated with them, now recurred to her, somber, ghastly, cold, like most passages of family history when brooded over in melancholy mood. The whole seemed little else but a series of calamity, reproducing itself in successive generations, with one general hue and varying in little save the outline. But Hepzibah now felt as if the judge, and Clifford, and herself, they three together, were on the point of adding another incident to the annals of the house, with a bolder relief of wrong and sorrow, which would cause it to stand out from all the rest. Thus it is that the grief of the passing moment takes upon itself an individuality, and a character of climax, which it is destined to lose after a while, and to fade into the dark gray tissue common to the grave or glad events of many years ago. It is but for a moment, comparatively, that anything looks strange or startling, a truth that has the bitter and the sweet in it. But Hepzibah could not rid herself of the sense of something unprecedented at that instant passing and soon to be accomplished. Her nerves were in a shake. Instinctively she paused before the arched window and looked out upon the street in order to seize its permanent objects with her mental grasp, and thus to steady herself from the reel and vibration which affected her more immediate sphere. It brought her up, as we may say, with a kind of shock, when she beheld everything under the same appearance as the day before, and numberless preceding days, except for the difference between sunshine and sullen storm. Her eyes traveled along the street, from doorstep to doorstep, noting the wet sidewalks, with here and there a puddle in hollows that had been imperceptible until filled with water. She screwed her dim optics to their acutest point, in the hope of making out, with greater distinctness, a certain window, where she half saw, half guessed, that a tailor's seamstress was sitting at her work. Hepzibah flung herself upon that unknown woman's companionship, even thus far off. Then she was attracted by a chaise rapidly passing, and watched its moist and glistening top and its splashing wheels until it had turned the corner, and refused to carry any further her idly trifling, because appalled and overburdened, mind. When the vehicle had disappeared, she allowed herself still another loitering moment, for the patched figure of good Uncle Venner was now visible, coming slowly from the head of the street downward, with a rheumatic limp, because the east wind had got into his joints. Hepzibah wished that he would pass yet more slowly, and befriend her shivering solitude a little longer. Anything that would take her out of the grievous present, and interpose human beings betwixt herself and what was nearest to her,
whatever would defer for an instant the inevitable errand on which she was bound. All such impediments were welcome. Next to the lightest heart, the heaviest is apt to be most playful. Hepzibah had little hardihood for her own proper pain, and far less for what she must inflict on Clifford. Of so slight a nature, and so shattered by his previous calamities, it could not well be short of utter ruin to bring him face to face with the hard, relentless man who had been his evil destiny through life. Even had there been no bitter recollections, nor any hostile interest now at stake between them, the mere natural repugnance of the more sensitive system to the massive, weighty, and unimpressible one must in itself have been disastrous to the former. It would be like flinging a porcelain vase with already a crack in it against a granite column. Never before had Hepzibah so adequately estimated the powerful character of her cousin Jaffrey, powerful by intellect, energy of will, the long habit of acting among men, and, as she believed, by his unscrupulous pursuit of selfish ends through evil means. It did but increase the difficulty that Judge Pyncheon was under a delusion as to the secret which he supposed Clifford to possess. Men of his strength of purpose and customary sagacity, if they chanced to adopt a mistaken opinion in practical matters, so wedge it and fasten it among things known to be true, that to wrench it out of their minds is hardly less difficult than pulling up an oak. Thus, as the judge required an impossibility of Clifford, the latter, as he could not perform it, must needs perish. For what, in the grasp of a man like this, was to become of Clifford's soft, poetic nature, that never should have had a task more stubborn than to set a life of beautiful enjoyment to the flow and rhythm of musical cadences? Indeed, what had become of it already? Broken, blighted, all but annihilated, soon to be wholly so. For a moment the thought crossed Hepzibah's mind, whether Clifford might not really have such knowledge of their deceased uncle's vanished estate as the judge imputed to him. She remembered some vague intimations on her brother's part, which, if the supposition were not essentially preposterous, might have been so interpreted. There had been schemes of travel and residence abroad, daydreams of brilliant life at home, and splendid castles in the air, which it would have required boundless wealth to build and realize. Had this wealth been in her power, how gladly would Hepzibah have bestowed it all upon her iron-hearted kinsman to buy for Clifford the freedom and seclusion of the desolate old house. But she believed that her brother's schemes were as destitute of actual substance and purpose as a child's pictures of its future life while sitting in a little chair by his mother's knee. Clifford had none but shadowy gold at his command, and it was not the stuff to satisfy Judge Pyncheon. Was there no help in their extremity? It seemed strange that there should be none with a city round about her. It would be so easy to throw up the window and send forth a shriek at the strange agony of which everybody would come hastening to the rescue, well understanding it to be the cry of a human soul at some dreadful crisis. But how wild, how almost laughable, the fatality, and yet how continually it comes to pass, thought Hepzibah, in this dull delirium of a world, that whosoever, and with however kindly a purpose, should come to help, they would be sure to help the strongest side. Might and wrong combined, like iron magnetized, are endowed with irresistible attraction. There would be Judge Pyncheon, a person eminent in the public view, of high station and great wealth, a philanthropist, a member of Congress and of the Church, and intimately associated with whatever else bestows good name. So imposing in these advantageous lights, that Hepzibah herself could hardly help shrinking from her own conclusions as to his hollow integrity. The judge on one side, and who on the other? The guilty Clifford, once a byword, now an indistinctly remembered ignominy.
Nevertheless, in spite of this perception that the judge would draw all human aid to his own behalf, Hepzibah was so unaccustomed to act for herself that the least word of counsel would have swayed her to any mode of action. Little Phoebe Pyncheon would at once have lighted up the whole scene, if not by any available suggestion, yet simply by the warm vivacity of her character. The idea of the artist occurred to Hepzibah. Young and unknown, mere vagrant adventurer as he was, she had been conscious of a force in Holgrave which might well adapt him to be the champion of a crisis. With this thought in her mind, she unbolted a door, cobwebbed and long disused, which had served as a former medium of communication between her own part of the house and the gable where the wandering daguerreotypist had now established his temporary home. He was not there. A book, face downward, on the table, a roll of manuscript, a half-written sheet, a newspaper, some tools of his present occupation, and several rejected daguerreotypes, conveyed an impression as if he were close at hand. But at this period of the day, as Hepzibah might have anticipated, the artist was at his public rooms. With an impulse of idle curiosity that flickered among her heavy thoughts, she looked at one of the daguerreotypes and beheld Judge Pyncheon frowning at her. Fate stared her in the face. She turned back from her fruitless quest with a heart-sinking sense of disappointment. In all her years of seclusion, she had never felt, as now, what it was to be alone. It seemed as if the house stood in a desert, or, by some spell, was made invisible to those who dwelt around or passed beside it, so that any mode of misfortune, miserable accident, or crime might happen in it without the possibility of aid. In her grief and wounded pride, Hepzibah had spent her life in divesting herself of friends. She had willfully cast off the support which God has ordained his creatures to need from one another, and it was now her punishment that Clifford and herself would fall the easier victims to their kindred enemy. Returning to the arched window, she lifted her eyes, scowling, poor, dim-sighted Hepzibah, in the face of heaven, and strove hard to send up a prayer through the dense gray pavement of clouds. Those mists had gathered, as if to symbolize a great brooding mass of human trouble, doubt, confusion, and chill indifference, between earth and the better regions. Her faith was too weak, the prayer too heavy to be thus uplifted. It fell back, a lump of lead, upon her heart. It smote her with the wretched conviction that Providence intermeddled not in these petty wrongs of one individual to his fellow, nor had any balm for these little agonies of a solitary soul, but shed its justice and its mercy in a broad, sun-like sweep over half the universe at once. Its vastness made it nothing. But Hepzibah did not see that, just as there comes a warm sunbeam into every cottage window, so comes a love beam of God's care and pity for every separate need. At last, finding no other pretext for deferring the torture that she was to inflict on Clifford, her reluctance to which was the true cause of her loitering at the window, her search for the artist, and even her abortive prayer, dreading also to hear the stern voice of Judge Pyncheon from below stairs, chiding her delay, she crept slowly, a pale, grief-stricken figure, a dismal shape of woman, with almost torpid limbs, slowly to her brother's door, and knocked. There was no reply. And how should there have been? Her hand, tremulous with the shrinking purpose which directed it, had smitten so feebly against the door that the sound could hardly have gone inward. She knocked again. Still no response. Nor was it to be wondered at. She had struck with the entire force of her heart's vibration, communicating, by some subtle magnetism, her own terror to the summons. Clifford would turn his face to the pillow and cover his head beneath the bedclothes, like a startled child at midnight. She knocked a third time, three regular strokes, gentle but perfectly distinct,
and with meaning in them, for, modulate it with what cautious art we will, the hand cannot help playing some tune of what we feel upon the senseless wood. Clifford returned no answer.
"Clifford, dear brother,"
said Hepzibah,
"shall I come in?"
A silence. Two or three times and more, Hepzibah repeated his name without result, till, thinking her brother's sleep unwontedly profound, she undid the door, and entering, found the chamber vacant. How could he have come forth, and when, without her knowledge? Was it possible that, in spite of the stormy day, and worn out with the irksomeness within doors, he had betaken himself to his customary haunt in the garden, and was now shivering under the cheerless shelter of the summer-house? She hastily threw up a window, thrust forth her turbaned head and the half of her gaunt figure, and searched the whole garden through, as completely as her dim vision would allow. She could see the interior of the summer-house, and its circular seat, kept moist by the droppings of the roof. It had no occupant. Clifford was not thereabouts, unless, indeed, he had crept for concealment, as for a moment Hepzibah fancied might be the case, into a great wet mass of tangled and broad-leaved shadow, where the squash-vines were clambering tumultuously upon an old wooden framework, set casually aslant against the fence. This could not be, however. He was not there, for while Hepzibah was looking, a strange grimalkin stole forth from the very spot and picked his way across the garden. Twice he paused to snuff the air, and then anew directed his course toward the parlor window. Whether it was only on account of the stealthy, prying manner common to the race, or that this cat seemed to have more than ordinary mischief in his thoughts, the old gentlewoman, in spite of her much perplexity, felt an impulse to drive the animal away, and accordingly flung down a window-stick. The cat stared up at her like a detected thief or murderer, and the next instant took to flight. No other living creature was visible in the garden. Chanticleer and his family had either not left their roost, disheartened by the interminable rain, or had done the next wisest thing, by seasonably returning to it. Hepzibah closed the window. But where was Clifford? Could it be that, aware of the presence of his evil destiny, he had crept silently down the staircase while the judge and Hepzibah stood talking in the shop, and had softly undone the fastenings of the outer door and made his escape into the street? With that thought, she seemed to behold his gray, wrinkled, yet childlike aspect in the old-fashioned garments which he wore about the house, a figure such as one sometimes imagines himself to be, with the world's eye upon him, in a troubled dream. This figure of her wretched brother would go wandering through the city, attracting all eyes, and everybody's wonder and repugnance, like a ghost, the more to be shuddered at because visible at noontide. To incur the ridicule of the younger crowd that knew him not, the harsher scorn and indignation of a few old men who might recall his once familiar features. To be the sport of boys who, when old enough to run about the streets, have no more reverence for what is beautiful and holy, nor pity for what is sad, no more sense of sacred misery sanctifying the human shape in which it embodies itself, than if Satan were the father of them all. Goaded by their taunts, their loud shrill cries and cruel laughter, insulted by the filth of the public ways which they would fling upon him, or, as it might be, distracted by the mere strangeness of his situation, though nobody should afflict him with so much as a thoughtless word, what wonder if Clifford were to break into some wild extravagance which was certain to be interpreted as lunacy? Thus Judge Pyncheon's fiendish scheme would be ready accomplished to his hands. Then Hepzibah reflected that the town was almost completely water-girdled. The wharves stretched out towards the center of the harbor, and, in this inclement weather, were deserted by the ordinary throng of merchants, laborers, and seafaring men,
each wharf a solitude, with the vessels moored stem and stern along its misty length. Should her brother's aimless footsteps stray thitherward, and he but bend one moment over the deep black tide, would he not bethink himself that here was the sure refuge within his reach, and that, with a single step or the slightest overbalance of his body, he might be forever beyond his kinsman's grip? Oh, the temptation! To make of his ponderous sorrow a security, to sink with its leaden weight upon him, and never rise again. The horror of this last conception was too much for Hepzibah. Even Jaffrey Pyncheon must help her now. She hastened down the staircase, shrieking as she went.
"Clifford is gone!" she cried. "I cannot find my brother. Help, Jaffrey Pyncheon! Some harm will happen to him!"
She threw open the parlor door, but what with the shade of branches across the windows, and the smoke-blackened ceiling, and the dark oak panelling of the walls, there was hardly so much daylight in the room that Hepzibah's imperfect sight could accurately distinguish the judge's figure. She was certain, however, that she saw him sitting in the ancestral armchair, near the center of the floor, with his face somewhat averted, and looking towards a window. So firm and quiet is the nervous system of such men as Judge Pyncheon, that he had perhaps stirred not more than once since her departure, but, in the hard composure of his temperament, retained the position into which accident had thrown him.
"I tell you, Jaffrey,"
cried Hepzibah impatiently, as she turned from the parlor door to search other rooms,
"my brother is not in his chamber. You must help me seek him."
But Judge Pyncheon was not the man to let himself be startled from an easy chair with haste ill-befitting either the dignity of his character or his broad personal basis by the alarm of an hysteric woman. Yet, considering his own interest in the matter, he might have bestirred himself with a little more alacrity.
"Do you hear me, Jaffrey Pyncheon?"
screamed Hepzibah as she again approached the parlor door, after an ineffectual search elsewhere.
"Clifford is gone!"
At this instant, on the threshold of the parlor, emerging from within, appeared Clifford himself. His face was preternaturally pale, so deadly white, indeed, that, through all the glimmering indistinctness of the passageway, Hepzibah could discern his features as if a light fell on them alone. Their vivid and wild expression seemed likewise sufficient to illuminate them. It was an expression of scorn and mockery, coinciding with the emotions indicated by his gesture. As Clifford stood on the threshold, partly turning back, he pointed his finger within the parlor, and shook it slowly as though he would have summoned, not Hepzibah alone, but the whole world, to gaze at some object inconceivably ridiculous. This action, so ill-timed and extravagant, accompanied, too, with a look that showed more like joy than any other kind of excitement, compelled Hepzibah to dread that her stern kinsman's ominous visit had driven her poor brother to absolute insanity. Nor could she otherwise account for the judge's quiescent mood than by supposing him craftily on the watch, while Clifford developed these symptoms of a distracted mind.
"Be quiet, Clifford,"
whispered his sister, raising her hand to impress caution.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, be quiet."
"Let him be quiet. What can he do better?" answered Clifford, with a still wilder gesture, pointing into the room which he had just quitted. "As for us, Hepzibah, we can dance now. We can sing, laugh, play, do what we will. The weight is gone, Hepzibah. It is gone off this weary old world, and we may be as light-hearted as little Phoebe herself."
And in accordance with his words, he began to laugh, still pointing his finger at the object, invisible to Hepzibah, within the parlor. She was seized with a sudden intuition of some horrible thing. She thrust herself past Clifford, and disappeared into the room, but almost immediately returned with a cry choking in her throat.
gazing at her brother with an affrighted glance of inquiry, she beheld him all in a tremor and a quake, from head to foot, while, amid these commoted elements of passion or alarm, still flickered his gusty mirth.
"My God! What is to become of us?" gasped Hepzibah.
"Come," said Clifford in a tone of brief decision, most unlike what was usual with him. "We stay here too long. Let us leave the old house to our cousin Jaffrey. He will take good care of it."
Hepzibah now noticed that Clifford had on a cloak, a garment of long ago, in which he had constantly muffled himself during these days of easterly storm. He beckoned with his hand, and intimated, so far as she could comprehend him, his purpose that they should go together from the house. There were chaotic, blind, or drunken moments in the lives of persons who lack real force of character, moments of test in which courage would most assert itself, but where these individuals, if left to themselves, stagger aimlessly along, or follow implicitly whatever guidance may befall them, even if it be a child's. No matter how preposterous or insane, a purpose is a godsend to them. Hepzibah had reached this point. Unaccustomed to action or responsibility, full of horror at what she had seen, and afraid to inquire, or almost to imagine, how it had come to pass, affrighted at the fatality which seemed to pursue her brother, stupefied by the dim, thick, stifling atmosphere of dread which filled the house as with a death smell, and obliterated all definiteness of thought. She yielded without a question, and on the instant, to the will which Clifford expressed. For herself, she was like a person in a dream, when the will always sleeps. Clifford, ordinarily so destitute of this faculty, had found it in the tension of the crisis.
"Why do you delay so?" cried he sharply. "Put on your cloak and hood, or whatever it pleases you to wear. No matter what, you cannot look beautiful nor brilliant, my poor Hepzibah. Take your purse, with money in it, and come along."
Hepzibah obeyed these instructions, as if nothing else were to be done or thought of. She began to wonder, it is true, why she did not wake up, and at what still more intolerable pitch of dizzy trouble her spirit would struggle out of the maze and make her conscious that nothing of all this had actually happened. Of course it was not real. No such black easterly day as this had yet begun to be. Judge Pyncheon had not talked with her. Clifford had not laughed, pointed, beckoned her away with him, but she had merely been afflicted, as lonely sleepers often are, with a great deal of unreasonable misery in a morning dream.
"Ha! Now, I shall certainly awake,"
thought Hepzibah, as she went to and fro, making her little preparations.
"I can bear it no longer. I must wake up now."
But it came not, that awakening moment. It came not, even when, just before they left the house, Clifford stole to the parlor door and made a parting obeisance to the sole occupant of the room.
"What an absurd figure the old fellow cuts now," whispered he to Hepzibah. "Just when he fancied he had me completely under his thumb. Come, come, make haste, or he will start up, like giant despair in pursuit of Christian and Hopeful, and catch us yet."
As they passed into the street, Clifford directed Hepzibah's attention to something on one of the posts of the front door. It was merely the initials of his own name, which, with somewhat of his characteristic grace about the forms of the letters, he had cut there when a boy. The brother and sister departed, and left Judge Pyncheon sitting in the old home of his forefathers, all by himself, so heavy and lumpish that we can liken him to nothing better than a defunct nightmare, which had perished in the midst of its wickedness, and left its flabby corpse on the breast of the tormented one, to be gotten rid of as it might. End of chapter.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.